And the next thing he and his cohorts did is they emptied all the jails in Czechoslovakia under the assumption that anybody who had been in prison under the communist system was a victim of the system and a decent fellow. They let them all out, and then the article goes on to say, and they discovered that they had released substantial numbers of really unsavory and violent criminals. I mean, you shouldn't really criticize Havel. If you criticize Havel, I have two critiques of him, two mentions of him, in my book Land of Idols, where I talk about his mysticism and his anti-democracy mysticism. And also I mentioned that the guy was raised by chauffeurs and governesses and was very rich, and he had a particular perspective. I can't tell you the academic Bobby Soxers who adore Havel and wrote me, the reviewers all made a point of saying, you shouldn't say this about Havel. He's a playwright, he's an intellectual, he's sensitive.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on Fascism, the False Revolution. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
One of the things conveniently overlooked by mainstream scholar propagandists is the way that Western capitalist states have tolerated and cooperated with fascism. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, as you know, was positively cozy. He and many of his class saw Hitler as a bulwark against communism in Germany, and they saw a Nazi Germany as a bulwark against communism in Europe. After World War II, the Western capitalist allies did little to eradicate fascism from Italy or Germany, except for the Nuremberg trials. But the police, the courts, the military, security agencies, the bureaucracy have remained largely staffed by those who had served the former Nazi regimes or their ideological recruits. And that remains true to this day. I mean, how do you murder 6 million Jews, 250,000 gypsies, several million Ukrainians, Russians, Poles, and others, and thousands of homosexuals, and get away with it? Unless the only way you get away with it is that the very people who are supposed to look into these crimes were themselves complicit. What happened to the U.S. businesses that collaborated with fascism? Corporations like DuPont, Ford, General Motors, ITT, they own factories in these enemy countries that produce fuel, tanks, and planes that wreak havoc on Allied forces during World War II. And after the war, instead of being prosecuted for treason, ITT collected $27 million from the U.S. government for war damages inflicted on its German plants by Allied bombings. General Motors collected $33 million. Pilots were given instructions not to hit certain factories. The devastation of Cologne. There were several factories owned by ITT and Chrysler that after a while the German people learned to go in there and use them for air raid shelters because they wouldn't get hit by the American pilots because they were owned by the American corporate interests. Since the war, U.S. leaders have done their part in keeping Italian fascism alive, giving millions of dollars to right-wing organizations and neo-fascist organizations in Italy. In 1975, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger met with the Italian fascist leader Giorgio Almirante in Washington to discuss what alternatives might be considered should the Italian communists win the election and take control of the government. Over the years, fascist terror groups have engaged in assassinations and bombings in any number of Western European countries to destabilize the existing democracies, what's called the strategy of tension. While the U.S. press focused on the Red Brigades, some Italian newspapers pointed out that most of the killings and the other acts of violence were perpetrated by fascist groups, most of which were shown a generous tolerance by the police. As you all know, a coalition of neo-fascist and separatist groups headed by media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi won the 1994 elections in Italy. Their platform, a single tax rate for rich and poor alike, school vouchers, a stripping away of the welfare state, the introduction of private retirement accounts, and of course, the privatization of just about everything. Ladies and gentlemen, the Italian neo-fascists are learning from the American reactionaries how to achieve fascism's goals under democratic forms with democratic facades. You use an upbeat Reagan-esque optimism. You convince people that government is the enemy, especially its social democracy aspects. At the same time, you strengthen the repressive capacities of the state. You instigate resentments against the newly arrived immigrants, that's going on in Italy right now, and you preach the imaginary virtues of the free market. So we might do well to stop thinking of fascism as a simple either-or condition. The political system of any one country encompasses a variety of seemingly incongruous institutional practices. I mean, to insist that you don't have fascism until every vestige of constitutional government is destroyed and the jackboot is right on our necks is to really overlook the very disturbingly anti-democratic manifestations inherent in many states that call themselves democracies, especially in their dealings with left dissenters. You know, the political center is always described as kind of the moderate place between the extremes of left and right, and fighting a war on two fronts against right and left. A closer reading of history should tell us that the center is more inclined to make common cause with the right against the left. And this is because the center and the right share a commitment to corporate capitalism and the free market mythology. Throughout the Weimar Republic, Franz Neumann, he wrote, I quote, "Every law aimed supposedly against both communists and Nazis was invariably enforced against the entire left, but rarely against anyone on the right." Unquote. Well, I'm paraphrasing. This is Neumann actually going on his thought. Those leftists who were critical of the illegal rearmament of Germany during the Weimar found themselves charged and tried for treason, while rightist assassins and pushists were, quote, either not prosecuted at all or dealt with lightly. In fact, Neumann brings together some very interesting statistics, which for some reason he sticks in a footnote, but I think they're very important. The prosecution of political murders in the centrist Social Democratic Weimar Republic, 1918 to 1922. Left groups were charged with committing 22 murders. For those 22 murders, 38 people were found guilty. 10 people were executed. The average time served in prison of the others was 15 years. Right-wing groups committed hundreds and hundreds of murders, only 354 of which were investigated. 326 were not even prosecuted at all. 23 people were discharged, let go, despite entering guilty pleas. 24 were found guilty in part. Not one was executed. Average time served, 4 months. Now, this double standard of the centrist state in dealing with the left and right, I would say, continues to this day in the United States and most other Western capitalist nations. I mean, consider how, for generations, how gently the murderous, lynching night riders, the Ku Klux Klan, was treated by federal authorities in this country. Compare that to the way the Black Panthers were treated. Consider how the right is investigated compared to the left. When the Center for Cuban Studies in New York was bombed by a right-wing Cuban group, which boasted, admitted they did the act, the FBI didn't have a clue, couldn't find them. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got a call from the FBI myself. The guy says, "I'm not making this up." They said, "Mr. Parenti, we'd like to come and see you because we have a charge here that you may be the Unabomber." They said, "Sir, could we come and talk to you?" I said, "I wouldn't miss this for the world." I'm not going to go any further. You'll see the movie. The way the mainstream shades off into the fascist right can be seen quite clearly in the Republican Party. the GOP agenda today is really not much different from the kind pushed by Mussolini and Hitler. It's fascism without the swastika. It's fascism in a pinstripe suit. First, break the labor unions, depress wages, impose a rightist ideological monopoly over the media. The rest of the GOP agenda, as you know, eliminate cultural dissidents in the arts, attack the rights of women and gays, abolish taxes for the big corporations and the rich, eliminate government regulations designed for worker and consumer safety and environmental protection, privatize and plunder public lands and enterprises, wipe out public services, and cloak this whole reactionary agenda in a kind of a revolutionary sound. You know, we got a revolution going here in Congress. Some revolution. It's the same old reactionary class agenda. And today in the United States, we witness some middle-class Americans, like the middle-class Germans of yore, beset by real economic difficulties. They really are facing economic injustices, real ones, and they're turning their anger toward irrelevant or imaginary foes. The immigrants, the Jews, the poor, the welfare mothers, people of color, feminists, gays, atheists, and others. There's something else I think that's happened that explains the speed up of reactionism in America today, and that is the fact that for years, the United States leaders and political and economic elites saw themselves in mortal combat with communism for the allegiance of peoples at home and abroad. The argument was made that U.S. workers enjoyed a higher standard of living than their counterparts who lived under communism. I mean, it's a very conscious thing. Civil rights, too, the same thing. If we've got to compete with the communists for all these third world countries, people of color, we got to clean up our act, get rid of Jim Crow, segregation, all that sort of thing. That was always a theme. Our workers earn more. Our workers live better than anybody under communism. You live better. Stick with capitalism. Free enterprise is the best for you. And that was a conscious thing. The pressure of being in competition with an anti-capitalist alternative system set limits on how thoroughly the higher circles dared to mistreat the working populace. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, long before the collapse of communism, they tried to break unions, they tried to depress wages, they tried to do all these things. But now, I mean, they're pulling out the stops, they're dropping all pretenses at capitalism with a human face, you know. And they were always mindful. These people were always mindful of the potential threat of workers getting radicalized. Very much so in the 1930s, very much so in the 60s and even the 70s, and it comes out in their statements and all that. And by the way, of course, that wasn't the only restraining factor. It was also the working class's ability to fight back, to win democratic victories, gains, the eight-hour day, any number of historic victories, Social Security and various benefits and the like. When the communist nations were overthrown in Eastern Europe, there was much rejoicing among conservative circles. But within a very short time, there was a very interesting, querulous, irritated, irate note that began to appear in some of the conservative publications that I looked at. And it went like this. If in Eastern Europe, they're now moving toward a total free market, why must we here in the United States still have to tolerate these collectivistic, liberalish regulations and restraints that are put upon us? Now is the time to cast off all restraint and sock it to the public. The competition for their hearts and minds are over. There's no competing system to which they might think of turning. There's no need to tolerate any accommodation with those who have to work for a living. There's no reason why masses of people in this country should have a middle-class living standard, why working people should have that, or even so many middle-class people. It's time that these people lower their expectations, work harder, and be satisfied with less. The more they get, the more they'll demand, and we'll end up with a social democracy, or worse. Better to keep them down and hungry with their noses to the grindstone. It's time to return to the good old days. In Against Empire, I call it getting back to 1893. the kind of conditions that prevail in the third world, have a weak, unorganized, demoralized mass of people that work for subsistence. You have, even below them, a large contingent of desperately poor unemployed who help further to depress wages and can often become the object of resentment by the people just above them. And you have a small, insecure middle class that's hanging on by its bleeding fingers. And above that, a very tiny, obscenely rich owning class that has it all. Also, a change in attitude toward the Third World. During the Cold War and the competition with the Soviet Union, the whole option was development. We'll develop these countries, prosperity will come in, give them aid, and they will, middle class will develop, they'll get stabilized, and they will not succumb to the appeals of communism. Well, with the collapse of communism, there's been a shift in policy there too. First of all, they found that policy wasn't working. Third world governments began to close off key sectors of their economy. That's the only way you're going to develop it, is to close it off against U.S. capital competition. They were doing things like forming consortiums for better trade deals and better money deals. They were trying to break the global monopoly of Western media. They were looking for more authority over their own seabeds and resources and that sort of thing. And then they were producing goods that were competing with the U.S. market, even at home. So the new policy toward the third world is also a hard line. As with their own working class in the U.S., so with third world nations now. You've got nowhere else to go. You're not going to turn to Moscow now. Moscow's in our pocket. And so, bam, they're hitting them hard. The IMF, the World Bank, GATT, NAFTA, and undermining the sovereignty of third world nations, making an end run around them, directly plundering their markets. And drastically cutting non-military foreign aid to these countries. And in some cases, directly invading them and destroying the government that had any reformist tendencies or was maintaining economic development, as in the case of Iraq, Panama, and in, of course, a dozen reformist revolutionary governments. They've done that. So they don't have to worry about a communist competitor. U.S. leaders are making war against economic nationalism in countries like India, Brazil, Mexico, Iraq, Panama, South Korea, Taiwan, and so forth. There's a lot of people who still don't get it. They don't get it that these guys are playing for keeps, that they are going after you, that they are not going to leave any little bit left for you. There's only one thing that the ruling circles throughout history have ever wanted, and that's everything. There's only one thing they want. All the wealth, the treasures, and the profitable returns. All the choice lands and forests and game and herds and harvests and mineral deposits and precious metals of the earth. All the productive facilities and gainful inventiveness and technologies, all the control positions of the state and other major institutions, all public supports and subsidies, privileges and immunities, all the protections of the law and none of its constraints, all the services and comforts and luxuries and advantages of civil society with none of the taxes and none of the costs. Every ruling class in history has wanted only this, all the rewards and none of the burdens. Their operational code is, we have a lot, we can get more, we want it all. And if you don't know that, you're in a sad place. If you know that and you don't know anything else, you know more than if you know everything else and you don't know that. In the final analysis, the danger of fascism comes not from skinheads or the militia or the Christian right fanatics, but it comes from the ongoing practices of the national security state and its various enforcement agencies. It comes from the boardrooms of corporate America. But before we pronounce ourselves doomed, keep in mind that at the present time, right in these days now, there are people who are demonstrating and getting arrested and raising hell to protect the environment and the forests. There are others who are doing the same at nuclear submarine bases. There are people who are demonstrating for justice and against racism in the judicial system, as the national protests for Mumia Abu-Jamal demonstrate. There are people protesting against nuclear testing in the South Pacific, against against Medicare cuts and family assistance cuts, against the suppression of the homeless, against the anti-immigration laws, and for affirmative action. There are large majorities in this country who even support welfare, if you don't call it welfare. If you say, should government help the poor? Should government do more for the poor? It's surprising what people say. We have to get a lot angrier and a lot more determined. They want everything, and everything is at stake. Many people are getting angrier and angrier and increasingly concerned. Our job is to see that they direct their anger at the real perpetrators of their misery and not against the very people who want to make common cause with them. Well, Parenti, what do you have against wealth all the time I hear this talk? I mean, it trickles down, and more wealth, more wealth up there means more down for the rest of us. I just heard that recently by the ruling class propagandist Rush Limbaugh, the best mind on the right. He said, quote, this is pretty high-level stuff for Rush Limbaugh. He said, it's not a zero-sum society. A bigger pie is better for all. No, it is a zero-sum society, because the size of the pie is one thing, how it's sliced is another. If you take a 20-ounce pie, in which I got a 10% slice, and you shrink it down to a 15-ounce pie, and I now get a 70% slice, I like the 15-ounce pie better, at least the plutocrats would. And wealth doesn't trickle down. It is siphoned up from the labor of the many into the pockets of the few. I don't like great concentrations of private wealth because it causes public poverty. Corporate wealth is the greatest single cause of poverty. It is theft, and it makes a mockery of democracy. In fact, in every society where you have wealth, you have poverty. That's how you get wealth, by creating poverty. That's how the slave owner could live in such opulence and luxury, by having slaves who work at a bare subsistence and create this for him. That's how the feudal lords could live with their refineries and luxuries and their tables laden and groaning with food, by having serfs and servants working and producing this. And in the societies where you don't have great concentrations of wealth, you generally don't have mass poverty, or very little of it. It's a very interesting correlation. Wealth causes poverty, and that's what I got against wealth. Brothers and sisters, when labor is in retreat to capital, when the power of capital is increasingly untrammeled, all of us are put at risk. The environment, the sacred forests, the beautiful and mysterious creatures of the sea, the ordinary people who with their strength and brains and inventiveness create community and give to life so much that's worthy of our respect. The real burden to society is not the poor, but the corporate rich. We simply can no longer afford them. Conservatives complain whenever we fight back. And whenever we criticize their anti-democratic class privilege, they say we're engaging in class war. I mean, they engage in class war on our heads all the time, every day. Everything they do, every newspaper, every political ploy and move is doing this. Every lie they tell is consciously doing that. The minute we fight back and try to expose it, they say, oh, you're engaging in class war. Well, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I believe it is class war, but I also have another name for it. When people unite against the abuses of wealth and privilege, when they activate themselves and militantly attack the hypocrisies and lies of the powers that be, when they fight back and become the active agents of their own destiny, when they withdraw their empowering responses and refuse to toe that line, I have another name for that. I call that democracy. Their first loyalty is to the dollar, our first loyalty is to democracy and to the well-being of our society and our Mother Earth. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That was Michael Parenti on Fascism, the False Revolution. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded in Berkeley, California in 1995. Michael Parenti is a leading political analyst and author of many books. including Against Empire. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Jason Stanley, Thomas Suarez, Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Michael Parenti programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Michael Parenti, Fascism, The False Revolution, and for his classic book, Against Empire, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Billy Bragg. All you fascists are bound to lose.
All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. She's about to lose.
Started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language. Without being asked, I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. First off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us, because in our neighborhood, it's very clear. The industry wants to kill us, right? They put toxic chemicals, they put arsenic, mercury, dioxin into the air. That means they don't care about the kids who have to grow up in that neighborhood. That is not negotiable for me.
That's Maria Lopez Nunez, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. Parts of the United States are an eco-disaster, a sacrifice zone. Take parts of Newark, New Jersey. If you travel down a one-mile stretch of Doremus Avenue in Newark, you pass a natural gas plant next to a sewage treatment facility, next to an animal fat rendering plant, next to a series of ominous-looking chemical storage containers behind acres of fencing. Airplanes pass overhead every 2 minutes, their engines rattling windows, while a putrid smell wafts from the open pools at the sewage treatment plant. Nationally, where are these polluters located? Overwhelmingly in poor communities of color, like the Ironbound section of Newark, where activists are organizing and fighting back to create a just, vibrant, and sustainable community. Our guest today is Maria Lopez Nunez. She's deputy director of the Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark. She's an environmental justice organizer and plays a large role in activating and uplifting her community, while also pushing for policies to address environmental injustice locally, regionally, and nationally. She spoke at the Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maria Lopez Nunez. Happy to be here in Eugene, Oregon. I'm from Newark. Well, I'm from Honduras. I was born in Central America. Most of my life, I grew up with people not knowing where that country was, actually, until Trump put us on the map his first time as a whole country. So, you know, very excited. Haven't traveled the country much except to visit other environmental justice communities. So, of course, community, I'll tell you about mine first, the community I've served for the last 10 years under Ironbound Community Corporation, and that's in Newark, New Jersey. So Ironbound is a 4 square mile neighborhood, right? Just 4 square miles in the city of Newark. Most people fly to Newark to go to New York. Actually, when you land in Newark Airport, they tell you you've arrived in New York, but you're in a different state. You're actually across the river in New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. And Newark, New Jersey is home to the longest Superfund site in the country. That's 17 miles of a Superfund site. That's our Passaic River. The river surrounds us on two sides. It's a Superfund site because during the Vietnam War, we were the largest producers of Agent Orange. You know, Diamond Alkali, the producers of Agent Orange, had plants along the riverbank. They knew at the time that they had other ways to produce Agent Orange, but they chose to do it in the most toxic way. I guess if you're going to use it to poison people overseas, who cares if you poison some people at home, right? No need to do safety. So they were dumping the byproduct dioxin being, you know, one of the most cancer-causing things to human beings, straight into the river. I've talked to many workers that have now rare skin disease. They talk a lot about the white dust that covered everything in the plant. And that white dust would get on the truck wheels and then be wheeled all across the neighborhood. So I used to have colleagues that would swim. You know, there was a swimming pool in the neighborhood at the time. The swimming pool had dioxin in it, eventually having to be closed. There's actually some iconic pictures of neighborhood residents sitting, you know, on their stoop, on their porch. And these people from EPA, newly formed EPA, they're in toxic hazmat outfits, right? Looking like they're astronauts and people freaking out because they're in t-shirts, right? So we start seeing the divide of the community versus the experts pretty quick in the neighborhood of Ironbound. So the longest Superfund site in the country. It has over 100 brownfield sites in that 4 square miles. We are also host to the largest garbage incinerator in the state of New Jersey and in the region, and the largest sewage waste treatment facility. The sewage waste treatment facility would deal with the waste of 12 different states. So they would barge in waste into the neighborhood to be dealt with at PVSC. It's called the Passaic Valley Sewage Commission. I need y'all to understand what that smells like, right? That when you're dealing with the waste of 12 different states of over 4 million households, obviously that's not the people that live in our neighborhood. That's not even the people that live in our city. We were responsible for the waste, the human waste of 30 different municipalities. So, you know, I like to say, people don't think about things, right? You flush the toilet, do you give it a second thought? Maybe, if you don't feel good. I've had the pleasure to have to think about waste a lot. Waste of what happens when you throw something out. I should have started by saying, I don't believe in recycling, right? And I hope no one here does too. It's a sham by the fossil fuel industry. And in our neighborhood, we really got to see that plastic buildup, how plastic was changing the waste composition and changing what the incinerator was looking like, because plastic's not good for them either. It's too light. It burns too fast. It was making their process really out of control. So they had over 700 violations. I believe firmly that's because they were in a black and brown community, because there are incinerators, comparable incinerators, that would only have 40 violations in the same time period. So when we're talking about 40 to 700, that's an exponential increase that you see in a city like Newark. What I say about our city is we're not a poor city. You know, I hate a lot of environmental justice. It's often this conversation of pity, of, you know, we need to have empathy and sympathy for people that are in bad conditions. I saw it as a story of theft, right? Of theft of our resources and our human potential. Most of the people making billions of dollars off of our city's resources and land, they didn't live in our neighborhood. They didn't even live in our city or even close by. So Superfund site, the largest incinerator, the largest sewage waste treatment facility on the East Coast. And then we were also home to the largest port on the East Coast, right? The Port of Newark and Elizabeth is where 80% of the consumer goods in the Northeast come through on, you know, these huge ships from Asia so that we can all purchase all our crap, right? So when I think about that, when I think about everything from the dollar store to Fifth Avenue coming through our neighborhood, I think of all the money that just runs by my neighborhood. So it was interesting to be part of an administration that was trying to change that through Justice 40, right? So for those of you that don't know, Justice 40 was an attempt, a guidance, if you will, learn the difference between mandatory and guidance, right? But a guidance that 40% of our resources should go to 40% of the population that is of color, that is marginalized, low income, neglected communities. Look, I'm not a linear thinker, so you're going to have to come with me on this journey. I hope I won't bore you. That is one of my rules for organizing. Don't be boring. And I would say most of the environmental field, it can be kind of boring. It can be kind of boring to listen to. You glaze over and community members stop listening to the organizer at the front of the room, because our strategy for too long has been to shock and awe people, to make them afraid, right? In our small neighborhood, our organizing revolved around being friends with people. Very revolutionary. Making your neighbors your friends, you know, making it so that your neighbors want to hang out with you, that not every time that you're knocking on their door are you coming to them with a problem to solve, of like, you know, there's another thing coming into our neighborhood. So biggest, longest Superfund site, the garbage incinerator, the port of Newark, and Elizabeth. And then we were home to 3 power plants. And as of today, we are about to be home to 4 power plants in a 4-square-mile neighborhood. So when I think about that, you know, I think about what our neighborhood looks like. You would say it's mostly industry and then a little bit of people squeezed in there. And how I think I started making my mark in environmental justice is just because right place, right time. Anybody from a community could end up on a national circuit or being appointed to the White House. I think it's because you know, as we partnered with lawyers and academics, it was so important to fight for our space as the community voice. I mean, you have no idea the insecurity to have to speak to a public interest law, you know, environmental law conference to say, well, I don't even have an advanced degree. You know, I do organizing and I, you know, I've been at the White House quoted as saying regular ass people. Like, that's who we need to fill these rooms with, not just have rooms that are exclusively of lawyers or exclusively of academics. You know, while I was helping serve under the Biden administration, I was seeing that the rooms were too exclusive. You know, it was filled with professional advocates, quite frankly. Where do we have the real reflection of, like, who is in the room with us? Are there people that we don't know? Are there people that don't look like us and that have different life circumstances? Because if they're missing from the rooms, we're kidding ourselves to think we're going to go find them later or that somebody here knows them. Because if you know them, why aren't they in the room with us? So I have a lot of rules for organizing. I'm just going to sprinkle them in whenever. But like I said, one of them is definitely don't be boring. I think it's a criminal sin to bring people out to an event and then bore them to death. I would say don't be dumb. And I struggle with don't be dumb. Don't be dumb for me means if you don't know, don't pretend you know. That's what dumb is to me, right? When people pretend that they know something or pretend that they know a community because they know one sort of like it, communities in this country can't be generalized, as we saw during the elections, right? This might be controversial, but I'm okay with the fact that a lot of our environmental law, our efforts on climate change are burning down because I don't think a lot of them were good enough. In 2019, I was part of passing the country's strongest environmental justice law. It was called S-232, the Cumulative Impacts Law. Cumulative impacts is to address exactly what I was talking about, right? 4 power plants, a garbage incinerator, a sewage waste treatment plant, the Superfund site. The law did not allow our State Department of Environmental Protection to just do what a fourth grader can do. Look around. Look around and say, huh, there's way too much trash here. How the hell are you going to add another power plant? Because in this country, permitting works in the way that being from a different country, American, you know, ideology works, individualism. Every single power plant and facility is seen as an individual. Or is that individual facility going to go right up to the permit limit? It doesn't matter who's around them or the context of the neighborhood in environmental law. They're judged by themselves. They're not judged based on in a contextual nature to look around. The best we had was maybe there was a cumulative impact assessment. So many of our laws stop at assessment and then leave things up to the discretion of professionals. Professionals who are often white, who are often, you know, from privileged background, who may have never stepped foot in our neighborhood. If they could step foot in a neighborhood like Ironbound, they could see that you can taste the air. You should not be able to taste the air in the way that we can, which is, is that garbage? Or, you know, I forgot to say my favorite. We're home to a fat rendering plant in Newark. For those of y'all that don't know, fat rendering is like they take animal carcasses and they boil them until the fat separates from the bone so that we can, you know, engage in all sorts of beauty products so that you can get your gelatin for your gummy snacks, all sorts of products. It's called Darling. And that really was quite a smell. Became my favorite because it's the easiest to report, right? It smells like a dead animal that was being shipped on these open containers. So we would often in our neighborhood see the dead animals. They would spill all over the place on their way to the fat rendering plant. And that's what the kids in our neighborhood have grown up with. So when I think about our neighborhood, it is generations of kids that are impacted. When I think about our laws that, you know, we set goals that will be achieved in 10 to 15 years to people doing the work that I do, that's generations of kids that are going to grow up in the same conditions because things do not move fast enough. You know, we let the law play itself out. I have been sitting across lawyers countless times where they're like, hey, this seems great. They're going to phase out by 15 years. And I'm like, we have different priorities. This might look like an excellent settlement to you. For the people in our neighborhood that I am accountable to who used to know my address, right? And I would bump into in the supermarket. I can't come back to them and say, your problem will go away in 15 years. With the cumulative impact law, first off, it mandated that if a community was low income or language isolation or more, or it was 40% people of color or more, that probably indicated some sort of political vulnerability. And as we know, New Jersey's nickname is the Garden State, which makes no sense if you've been around New Jersey. But for the Garden State to be real, a place like Newark has to exist, right? Which is where you dump everything because of zoning. All the industrial cities, which is where the majority of black and brown people existed in our state, that's where you have the heavy industrial zoning. And so under that law, the Department of Environmental Protection has to take a further look in to see if a facility will contribute to the excess burdens, right? If they're actually going to increase that totality of burdens that are happening because of the different facilities. So what was interesting about that, first off, big fight to get those numbers down, to make sure it wasn't like a preposterous number. I believe industry wanted it to be like 70%, which would have been hyper segregation, right? We're 40% of the population, just about. So we're like, no, anytime that there is a further concentration. But the point is, anytime that they were looking into that, and if a facility was going to increase the burden, then the department shall deny, right? It was not may deny. It was, they had to deny that application. And that was it. It wasn't anything revolutionary. I'm almost, if I'm honest, embarrassed to talk about that law across the country because it's such a low bar. Yes, a neighborhood has already been harmed for generations, for decades. Yes, this neighborhood already has such a high concentration of pollution. The people already have adverse health incomes. 1 out of 4 kids in our neighborhood has asthma, right? Like, it is a terrible air quality. We suffer from, you know, high infant mortality rates, all the different statistics that I won't go into because you already know them. After we already found that that is true, we're not going to add yet another power plant, even though our governor just approved another power plant despite this law passing. And that's because, as y'all know, probably better than me, between a law passing and a law getting implemented, it's quite a distance. And so the law passed in 2020. And then in terms of making the rules, we did change how rules were made. As y'all know, a law passes, very exciting. Then an agency typically goes dark. They don't talk to anybody. Well, they don't talk to any community. They often do talk to their regulated community, right? That's where the word community is used. It's in the regulated community. So they actually were talking to us, community advocates. And it was interesting. I feel like both the life of the head of legal and my life were changed in that process because I was able to humanize the government worker on the other side and see what they were up against and to see just how much they didn't know about our community and the ways that we were impacted. So we were able to work together every other week we were meeting to just discuss, you know, different points of the rules and what we thought, which I thought I was fascinated by. And I was like, why aren't all rules made like this? Shouldn't they be made hand in hand with the stakeholders who will need to utilize these processes, with the organizations that need to spread the word about, hey, there's going to be a community meeting? Because to say there's going to be a community meetings about rules for a law is, again, it goes into the very boring category, right? It is hard to communicate that to people who are busy in our neighborhoods, who have 3 jobs, you know, have kids in school, or have so many competing interests. And then we have to tell them to attend a rulemaking thing. So in our fight for the EJ law, the unions got involved, obviously. They saw the law as slowing them down. I'm super pro-union, and I have to acknowledge that there is a lot of racism in some of the unions in our country, as we saw during this presidential election, as we see when certain unions, and I'll distinguish, right, certain unions have been against the climate legislation, the IRA, and so how do we reach out to folks like that to help them see themselves in that future. That's what, you know, in our movement, we talk a lot about the just transition. It's really about helping everyday people see themselves in that future. Because I have to acknowledge that when we talk about the Green Revolution, it doesn't even sound like it involves people from my community. It doesn't really even look black and brown. Forget about, you know, working class white American. It looks elitist. You know, we've been sold. Somehow Tesla went first, and now we see that all the horrors that are being committed at the White House. But Tesla was the face, right, of what a green revolution might look like. I was in rooms with a lot of environmental people talking about EV cars. I was like, what? First off, where are you getting that electricity from? This idea that anything electric is inherently good has been so destructive, because in communities like mine that are home to 4 power plants, we know that electricity is not neutral. Until we transform the grid, we're not going to be talking about electric appliances and cars. Like, we are, you know, kind of too far ahead in the story when we have to have some fundamental changes to the system. Let's see. In terms of organizing, please, A, I hope you remember, don't bore people. 2, don't assume that you're going to trauma bond with them because things are so bad. When we were fighting the sludge processing plant, our campaign slogan was stop shitting on Newark, right? Like, just cut through the crap, man. Say what it is. Say what it is and say it directly. Don't try to flowery language it. So many people are afraid to say what's really going on or how bad it is. You don't want to sound inflammatory, right? But I'm like, don't. Then you sound inflammatory in a very, you know, kind of almost waspy way where people are like, wait, is there a problem? Because there's too many formalities, right? Too many disclaimers and qualifications for the statement instead of just stop on Newark. Why did I say that? Because the head of the head of PR for the sludge processing facility, he said it, he had the audacity to say in an article that the way that they decided to come to Newark is they followed the feces, you know? And so to be part of a neighborhood where people have the audacity to be quoted in a paper saying they followed the feces, I saw it. I was like, perfect. Thank you. A perfect organizing opportunity. So we had very clear language. And that made it so that the politicians who were not on our side, they were like, hey, this isn't that bad. Like, first off, don't assume that politicians know what they're talking about. I would say, like, put yourself in a politician's shoes. There's a crowd of people, and I call us the pitchfork crowd. And I am a proud member, okay, of the pitchfork crowd. But I acknowledge that if you're facing a pitchfork crowd and everyone at a community meeting wants to, like, spit at you and be, you know, like, yell at you for things that may or may not be in your jurisdiction, that's a big thing that I try to teach our community members about, like, let's all learn together, because I don't know always, right, of who are we complaining to? Do they have the power to change it? Because so often we're not complaining to the correct people. And so that leads definitely to a lot of frustration. 2, how do we build relationships with those people? Yes, they're expected to serve us. They're public servants. You know, that's what they signed up for. Sure, sure, sure. We can say that. But they're human beings, right? And if you're facing the pitchfork crowd, and then on the other side, industry looks seductive, you know, they're over here like whining and dining them, telling them nice things about themselves. And having that relationship that does get built up over time, I think it's important then for us on this side to figure out a way to build relationships with elected officials. And that means that we don't always build our relationship when something is wrong. We need to actually really pay attention to them, because we're all human, right? Even the most, I don't care what anybody thinks, has a little people pleasing in them, especially if they decided to run for office. I think that must be the most, like, I want external validation. So it would be, we need to keep validating people by showing up to their hearings, to their boring ones, when our issue is not on the topic, is not, you know, on the agenda, because they're like, ooh, I'm being watched. I do think that as we're complaining and putting out criticisms on Trump, how at the local level are we showing up for democracy? Democracy doesn't happen because someone makes it law or not. We are the people that make democracy happen. You know, we have to show up. So when we were fighting that sludge plant, at all the elected officials. And we were showing up to all their things. So even though they were all on the side of the sludge plant, they ended up having to have a community meeting talking tough and coming out against the sludge plant. I don't know what's happening behind closed doors. I was aware that we were being played, but all that matters is the public record sometimes, right? Let me talk about my colleague, Ana Baptista, Dr. Ana Baptista. She's at the Tishman Center. 10 years before, when they were working on the zoning plan, and this is why it's important for all of us to get involved in minutia and boring things, then we don't have to tell our friends about the boring thing, but we have to be involved with them. She was able to get a list of exclusions, one of them including no sludge processing, right? So we're there, and I had been talking to lawyers who just wanted me to file a petition, and I was very unsatisfied by that. I was like, no, I don't want to just file a petition. We're going to lose if we wait for this to drag out in court. She wakes up. We had 5 hours left to the deadline. I was like, I guess there's no other option. And she remembered that 10 years before, she had been able to put in the exclusion, no sludge processing. And they were clearly a sludge processing facility. So I was able to go back to the lawyer and say, we're switching the strategy. We're going to forget about the permit, you know, because we're always fighting the permits. By the time they're at permitting level, it's probably too late. It is very hard to fight a permit with agencies that think that they are meant to serve industry. They don't think they're meant to serve us. No matter how many times we say Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Environmental Protection, that's not what they're doing. They're serving industry. How do they make it as easy for them to comply with the law? Because the law is so subpar and does not really protect us, right? It's just a license to pollute, really. That's what I think most permitting laws are.
You're listening to Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
And look, this is not to discredit the wonderful work. I know it's been hard. But for communities like ours, we've been failed by Democrats and Republicans for decades, you know? So when I think about environmental justice, we're not terribly shook about Trump because it is more of the same and just somehow unveiled, right? Like I often don't know, is it better for you to look like my friend or act like my friend and betray me or just be outright betraying me? I think our communities are grappling with that. And that's why there's been so much disinvestment from our communities in these past couple of years. So with the sludge processing facility, we then changed, you know, we changed the battleground of our fight and we came to the local level. We had over 250 people on a zoning board meeting. The reporters were like, what the hell? It was 1 a.m. and we were still fighting with them, you know, keeping these commissioners on way past their bedtime, right? They're not used to public engagement. And that's something the right has done extremely well, is show up at the school boards, you know, boards that we've let go by because we're trying to fight the big fight at the federal level. With the environmental justice law, we had Chris Christie at the state. So we decided to pass a local ordinance at the city level in Newark in 2015. We passed the EJ local ordinance. So I would say right now in the times of Trump, we really do need to think about our state and local strategies. And not just say state and local strategies, like actually, what are you going to pass? What are you building right now that then when the circumstances change in 28, when there's a transformation in 2028, we're ready for it. We are ready to suggest the laws that should pass. And then we could say, you know what? That law exists in Eugene, Oregon. You know, it was passed in Eugene first, then Portland, and then it became Oregon state law. And so we want to model after that. With the EJ law in New Jersey, we've helped people work on it in New Mexico, in Minnesota, in Chicago, in Baltimore. You know, there's been so many other states trying to emulate us. And we've been trying to make sure that they all keep the bar where it is, shall deny. I'm like, none of you better go for a may deny or an assessment. You know, you better keep that bar, keep it strong, build on top of it. Make sure that includes renewals. Our law does not include renewals. It only includes like new facilities, right? So in a lot of ways, our law is just about stopping the future pain. It doesn't do anything to correct what the harm that has already been done. So let's see. Yeah, don't trauma bond with people. make sure you have concerts and your places where people just dance and party together. Because like I said, no one likes that friend that only comes around when there's bad news. You know, that friend's emotionally toxic. So don't be that friend if you're organizing. That also means that if you're an academic or a legal scholar or a lawyer that's working with a community, don't just show up to the meetings about the bad thing. Show up. And hopefully they're a good community organization, but that they are doing things that bring people happiness and that serve people's other needs. In my bio, it was talked about the Compassion in New Jersey law. I'm fully environmental justice, but we were working on making sure people weren't getting evicted. Because guess what? When people don't get evicted because of the work you did, they're going to show up for you for a hearing. That's how I was able to get, you know, hundreds of people to show up to a rulemaking meeting. And that surprised. I mean, I had union members following me into the bathroom trying to intimidate me and make me back down with the EJ law. I've had my house broken into, my tire slashed, my dog let out, right? Like, industry doing just enough to let me feel insecure. I come from a country where environmental advocates are just shot in the face. So I'm kind of okay. I'm like, hey, you know, we're in the U.S., you probably won't kill me, and that feels pretty good. So I think we should all feel a little sigh of relief. We're as bad as it's getting in this country. We need to always remember how much worse it could be. We are not there, you know, so let's not feed into this fear thing that I see happening of like, this is the worst. We're already in fascism. It's already Nazi. I'm like, no, it's actually not there yet. And saying that it is, right, and contributing to a little bit of all that trauma that gets, you know, echo chambered around us is not helping. How is it that we're sharing the light with each other of what's possible, of what's not happening here, of the atrocities that do happen to advocates in other countries? Because I would venture to say most people, including myself, hey, I was raised in this country. I came here when I was 2. So I look at my mom's degree of toughness and I'm like, as tough as I seem, I'm pretty soft. And so I think it's really important to keep that perspective, that global perspective, because we owe a responsibility to the people in other countries to make sure it does not get that bad here, to make sure that in the belly of the beast, there is resistance and that we're not going passively into the night. And that's where I believe a lot of the folks in this room, you have such an important piece to play. Because when Trump started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. To be part of, first off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president.